Hello, hello, hello. Good afternoon, good morning, good night.
Hello.
And is something technical going on? We've got really farther lower numbers than typical today. Is there like a party that no one invited me to? All right. Well, we should get going. I don't see some folks that I expected to be here, but well, life happens. I mean, hey, last week we had to do without our Canadian friends because it was Happy Canada Day. So that we'll do what we can. Welcome to the July 8th Aries Working Group call. We have some good discussions planned for today. This call is being recorded and will be posted afterwards. Previous recordings can be found there in the wiki. If you follow the working group link, then you can see previous agendas and recordings that show up at the bottom. These are Hyperledger meetings. So the Hyperledger Code of Conduct applies and the antitrust policy. This helps us to get along both legally and civilly, that we can make lots of forward progress on stuff and get along. And that's important. If you would like, you can add yourself to the attendees list. I will paste the link to this particular page in the chat. And if you would like to do so, is there anyone new here that hasn't been before and would like to introduce themselves?
So Sam, my name is Jack Su. I'm new. I'm actually from Boeing, and it's the first time for me on the call. Just hoping to listen in and learn.
Welcome, Jack. Did you say Boeing?
Yeah, I'm from Boeing. Yeah,
as in the airplane company.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh, perfect. Awesome. Okay. I just want to make sure I heard that right. Awesome. Welcome. Glad you're here.
Yeah. And I'm a Canadian as well. So I'm out of Vancouver.
We love Canadians. We're glad you're here. And I'm not just saying that because there's a lot of Canadians on the call today. I really do. Anyone else?
I'll just note that I think we should have a rule about limiting Canadian participation because they're overwhelming us.
Yeah, with all the work they're getting done, you mean? Yeah, yeah, that's terrible. No.
Well, I could have said they're just making us look bad, but that would be even worse.
We're trying to take over the world.
Well, hi guys. I'd like to introduce me. My name is Fernando Marino. I'm based in Brazil. I work in CPQD, that's a foundation of technology here in Brazil. And I'm working with blockchain and decentralized identity solutions here. Thank you.
Awesome. Welcome, Fernando. Glad you're here.
Thank you.
All right. Announcements. You probably know that John Jordan was in a fairly bad accident this last week. Kalia has arranged a sort of a community get well card that's at this link on Miro here. You can add a text box or a thing and kind of mark it up a little ad hoc style. And she is arranging for that to be printed and sent to John. And so that was awesome by Kalia. John is out of the ICU and in a spinal care unit. Hear reports that he is quite interested in keeping track of sort of what's going on in the community, and he may be listening to recorded calls, et cetera, to sort of keep abreast of what's going on. So our well wishes to both he and his family. So please do, if you'd like to sign that, I believe Friday was the day she was going to attempt to get it printed and sent. So if you'd like to add a note, then sooner is better than later. Yep, Drummond.
I was just going to say that I had the pleasure of talking with John's amazing wife, Manjit, last night. And she particularly said that John is very interested in anything that anyone in the community wants to share with them. In other words, just consider it like writing a letter, like in the old days, even if you send it via email. Just send him news about anything. A reality of his situation that I was not aware of is that normally a patient's family, when you're in this early stage of major spinal cord trauma, are there with them and that literally living with them together in the ward. But because of COVID right now, they can't do that. So I know it sounds just incredible, but he can have one visitor for 2 hours a day. That's it.
And wow.
And so right now that is Manjit. And so what she would like to do is, you know, obviously she fills that 2 hours very quickly, but he will be able, I'm not exactly sure. I know Stephen Kern is here. He might have more information on this, on John's ability to read all this. I mean, he's awake. He can't speak yet, but he can mouth words. He can communicate that way. And they think they're going to have him set up to be able to speak here within the next few days. But he's going to have his computer hopefully within by the end of the week. And so he will be able to to read. And so she said the most helpful thing right now is just send him a personal note, write him a letter, just about anything you think that he would be interested in.
Thank you, Drummond. And I imagine his email would be a reasonably good place to send that.
I suspect so too. She said anything between now and then, she can route to him. So you could send it to either Stephen Curran or myself. We'll get it there.
Yeah. Probably best to send it, you know, through me so I can see if you say anything bad about me, and then edit it and forward it on. I forwarded them to Manjeet and she's been reading them and shooting me back reactions and things like that, which has been awesome.
Good. Perfect. Thank you, Stephen and Drummond for keeping us updated and facilitating things. Okay, related meeting reviews. I'll offer on the DIDCOM working group one this next week. On Monday, we will be talking about Zuron Trip as opposed to more explicit protocols like DID Exchange, etc. So that will be a good conversation. If you're curious where things are going, that's worth eavesdropping on, and you can listen to recorded calls there as well. So that's on deck for this next week. Other calls that we want to report on.
In the identity working group, the implementers working group call last week, Oliver Turbu came and gave a good presentation on PsyOut. And that was, that's exciting. This is our off week, but we'll be meeting next Thursday, 9 a.m. U.S. Mountain Time.
Yeah, so this is the off week, but next week. And we'll give you a gentle reminder next week on this call.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
Was there any discussion of what Tobias and the Matter folks have talked about with OIDC, which is using the normal OIDC flow, but actually issuing a credential bound to the user? Has that been discussed at all?
So
talk about that?
I don't recall it in that exact verbiage, but what I do recall is that, well, I have the slides and those are available. But it seemed to flow that way, the way Oliver described it, that it was very much related to OIDC and that he followed that paradigm very closely and then linked it back over to the SSI so that you can call it from one to the other. And that's how it came across to me. So I think the answer to your question is yes, but in different language.
Yeah, it might be something to follow up on. I'll send you a link to it just to.
Okay. Cool, thank you.
Excellent. Other calls? All right, releases and work updates. Aries protocol test suite. I do see Keith. Any updates there?
No, nothing there.
Okay, Aries agent test harness.
Yeah, so things are moving forward. we did have a code with us from BC and Animo. From the Netherlands was selected. That's a team of folks you might have seen online. Timo is a person that has been interacting on Rocket Chat a fair amount. He's leading that group. There's three of them. They have created the Aries framework.net back channel Docker container, which is a requirement of the test harness. Several tests run, not many, and they're building that out. So we hope to have pretty soon have a full set of tests run between those two code bases, basically the two frameworks, ACAPI, which is already there, and .NET. So that's pretty exciting. We did some tweaks to the API to make it more friendlier to developers. So there's now going to be a sort of a full swagger list of all the operations that each back channel supports, and we'll be able to version that as we go forward, so that as we add tests, those will be added as a versioned mechanism to the API that a back channel supports. So exciting stuff.
Excellent. Airy shared libraries. This is doubly indented. Any updates there, Andrew? I guess that's your spot.
Yeah, so the hasn't been a lot of progress on the secure storage this week, but there was a new URSA release yesterday. So I've been updating the indie shared RS and getting crates published for that, and updating indie VDR to actually use those crates as dependencies.
Very cool. Aries Cloud Azure Python.
If I could, real quick, we this help wanted got answered last week. So we've got someone who's working on the did solve method based on indie VDR, which is kind of cool. That's generating a bunch of discussion that's going to raise some questions that we're going to want to talk about in the community. So I'll leave that for now, but that's to come. Akapai release 052 is out the door. List of things there. 053 unfortunately has to come pretty soon, because we discovered in the validation handling, or the the proof validation handling, there's a certain use case that is not supported that we have to add back in. So it's not urgent unless you actually hit this one issue related to a restriction by value of a claim. But we will put 053 out, and it just in case anyone sees that. We're waiting to see if anything else falls out as we redeploy everything we have on the newest release. So that's available. One of the things people may not realize is BCGov does maintain Docker images of Aries Cloud Agent Python base image that others can use for their use, but we also do for Indie Node. And we've got an image as well that'll be sort of the first of a series that is based on Indie VDR. So if you ever want to start from Docker images, we've got those available and published and maintained on a continuous basis.
Awesome. Thank you, Stephen. Aries Framework Go. I don't think I saw Troy. All right, Aries SDK Ruby, Jack. I don't see Jack as well. Different Jack, sorry, Jack. All right, and I don't see Tomislav. As far as the toolbox goes, I still have some pending things there. I have not been able to sort of get those quite over the finish line with other work that's been going on, but we have updates for the toolbox that will align it with new releases of Akapai. That's a little easier to do if they quit releasing things. I'm kidding. And so that will be updated a little bit. And the plugin for Akapai that allows it to work with the toolbox will be cleaned up as well. Good. Framework JavaScript. All right. Anything on Aries Mobile Agent Xamarin? And Brent is here. I skipped Rich Schemas on accident. Any updates there?
We're actually looking at ways to slightly modify the rich schema architecture in order to use the BBS plus LDSIGs as a first step, but nothing to share yet there. That's just a kind of an exploration.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And URSA, I heard there was an update. Anyone can share the URSA
update? We released 034 yesterday.
Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Cool. Okay, anything that I missed? All right. Continuing with our agenda, we have first a quick touch on RFC 348. That is the transition message types to HTTPS as a community update. We'll talk about that. The next is a discussion on tracing led by Ian to align the sort of the work and the goals that BCGov have been working on with the original intent of the tracing RFC to sort that out. And then I have some discussion about that I'm going to lead about the UX of accepting connections. I had a little bit on Rocket Chat and wanted to I put together a little bit of an outline of those concepts to discuss. And so we will, that's the plan. Are there any adjustments needed before we get going?
I would just like to say that although the tracing topic is important to me, I'd prefer to do that third and have it delayed a week if push comes to shove, because I really want to talk about the UX thing. So if it looks like we're running on time pressure, can we have a discussion about which item we need to talk about next?
We can. Ian, do you have a guess about how long you think it might take for that discussion?
I mean, I'm not sure how the discussion is going to go. I can kind of go through an overview of what we've done in about 5 minutes. I am away next week, so if we can't talk about it today, then it'll have to be out of 2 weeks. But again, I don't know what the priority of going through the tracing stuff is relative to everything else.
Why don't we plan to leave 45 minutes in the call to handle, or maybe 40 minutes to handle the UX discussion. Is that, do you think that will work okay, Daniel?
That'd be great.
Okay. So quickly, I wanted to address the status of this, and I brought this up last week as well. We have this transition from message types to HTTPS. There's a several steps, and we're in progress on step one, meaning that we accept both old and new. This is, again, the transition from using the old DID base of the protocol route to an HTTP one. And the goal was that in group one is that we could accept either. And then step two means that that we start defaulting to sending out the new format. And that's the next major step. The question was here is that we have a handful of things that are listed in the table with no steps completed. There is a PR from the IBM group indicating that, and it had, I haven't looked deeply into it, but it had something, GitHub was mad about something with the PR, Keith, but I did see that you had submitted that. Are there any questions or comments about this? This is meant to serve as another reminder to take a look at this and make sure that the code bases can be updated for that, so that we can, you know, make a decision about when to move on to step two. Any comments or?
Well, the big thing is we don't have the .NET framework folks available to talk, because we cannot do it without them.
That is very true. I'll try and reach out to them and see. Yeah, otherwise, consider this a reminder, and then we'll, hopefully we can get to enough info that we can, you know, decide about moving forward with this.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay. That's enough of that topic. Ian, why don't I stop sharing and pass the baton over to you?
All right. Should be able to see my screen now.
Yep.
So I'll just quickly, I'll take about 5 minutes and just cover what we've done in terms of the BCGov, and then maybe open it up after that, if that works for everyone. So the tracing RFC is 34, which is written by Daniel. I have an outstanding pull request on this RFC, which I think is the motivation for this discussion. All I've done is I've added a couple of sample JSON packets in terms of what we've actually implemented within Akamai. So the first one is the how tracing is actually added to the method. So we have a trace decorator that we've added. And another one is an example of the actual trace report, which we log to the endpoint. So the trace report is generated at different steps during the message processing, and it's logged based on the tracing configuration. It can either be logged to standard out to a log file, or it can be logged to an HTTP endpoint. The way we control this from Akamai is that we, let me find the right window. So within Akamai, when you start up the Akamai agent, we have some command line options around tracing. So you can define whether you actually want to generate trace events or not. The target, so you can target to log or HTTP endpoint. This one message is something that we've thought about. We haven't implemented this. This is something that we thought about, just kind of bundling the tracing within the message itself, so that as the message propagated through the agents, it would carry along the tracing with it. But like I say, right now we've got it. We can either dump the trace event to standard out to a log file or to an HTTP endpoint. And then there's a couple of parameters in terms of what we actually log. So there's a tag that we use with the HTTP logging. And then there's also a label, which is the agent name, so that we can determine who's actually doing the logging once we aggregate these things. And within our infrastructure, because we run everything on OpenShift and we scale the agents up with multiple pods, then the label actually includes the agent pod name as well, so that we can isolate logging for different agent pods. So within Akamai itself, in the demo, we have an example. We have a sample EFK stack that you can run. So that's the Elasticsearch, Fluentd, Kibana. So within here, there's a Docker file that you can actually run EFK, so that then you can, when you run the Akamai demo, you can actually point the Alice and Faber agents to Kibana, so you can do logging on your local. And then there's some command line options for running the demo that we've got just a short description. Specify parameters saying where you want to point the stuff to, and then you enable tracing on the Alice Faber demo. I should mention within Akamai, there's one other way that you can actually enable tracing. So you could, when you enable it through the command line parameters, it enables it globally, so it'll enable tracing for everything. But you can also do it on a per transaction basis, so that within the various admin APIs, then we have a trace option. So if tracing is turned off for the agent, you can still trace individual message exchanges just by passing in trace equals true on the admin API. And the idea with this one is that when we do performance testing, when we're doing a very heavy volume, we might want to do performance testing on, like, you know, 1% of the messages that go through would give us, you know, kind of an overall picture. Or we might want to, as we're running performance, we might just want to, on one message, we might want to do the tracing, and that'll give us a more manageable amount of information. And then in, once you actually run some transactions, then, for example, this is the Kibana interface. So if I've, for example, I ran a test around 10:53 where I ran a couple of transactions through and got some trace messages. And then this is just an example of how the tracing shows up in Kibana. You can grab by thread ID, for example, if you want to see the tracing for a particular message thread. And then there's another option in here where you can search by thread, and then that will give you the different trace messages that were generated for that individual thread's processing. And the source here is the actual trace message that we've generated. Um, I think that's about it. I mean, there's other options within Kibana that you can use for, I guess, you know, reporting and filtering and so forth on this data, or you can extract it and dump it to Excel for to doing Excel analysis. That's kind of, we're still kind of in the process with Akapai of doing our performance testing and pulling information out of the tracing and just seeing exactly how much information we can get out of it. So that's my quick overview. Any questions or comments?
Daniel, if I could pick on you, you had mentioned that you, you had worried that some of the things that they were doing were maybe not entirely in line with the spirit of the original tracing spec. Any thoughts or comments? They don't have to be complete ones as part of that conversation.
Yeah, could I share my screen real quickly?
Sure, let me stop sharing. Okay.
This will just be brief. This is just so that I can remember the things that I wanted to say. So it'll only take me 30 seconds to kind of describe it, and then I'll give up the screen again. I feel like this represents a subtle shift from what it was originally intended was DIDCOM tracing to agent tracing in a way. Some of that is kind of... a clue to that shift in emphasis is that the idea that this could be an agent level setting. Originally, the theory was that any party who's participating in a DIDCOM protocol of any kind could say, look, I need to be able to troubleshoot what's going on here. And so all the rest of you guys that are talking to me, which could be just one other party, but it could be multiples. Can you please help me troubleshoot by helping me record what you're seeing as this protocol unfolds? And I feel like the new way of thinking about this is an agent needs to know what's happening as it processes messages. And so we're going to tell the agent to record everything. That might be a simplification, but I hope you can see that that's a little bit of a shift in emphasis. And the second item I listed here is kind of related to that. The intent of the original was to help with troubleshooting, and it feels like the intent of the new version would be to help with like bulk analysis, get it into an Elk stack or something like that so that we can see what's happening across lots of different requests. And it used to be the case that the way you signaled this was you put a thing on one message, and if you put that thing on a message, then that message got traced. It wasn't intended to be a thing where you could say, hey, here's a setting that I want you to use going forward. So remember that I asked you to go into tracing mode. Rather, it was, every message that you want traced, say so. Kind of like when you send a message by postal service and you put a sticker on the outside saying this is certified mail. You don't say, I want to go into certified mail mode with all of my messages as they unfold from now on. You do that on every envelope that you send that way. And I'm not saying that the new way is wrong, but I think it may address a slightly different need. And so I'm wondering if we could split apart this topic and give names to the two different emphases, and they could possibly share some things. But I think that the trade-offs they make are a little bit different. That's probably enough to... I can be done sharing my screen, and that's the kind of the quick brain dump.
So the way that we've implemented in Akapai, I think, supports kind of both facets.
Right. So but I'm suggesting
You can configure an agent to log everything if you want, or because you can specify it through an admin API for a particular exchange, then you can trace a particular exchange. And when ACAPI receives a message that has the tracing decorator, it will trace even if the agent itself is not configured to do any tracing. So with ACAPI, it will, you know, if someone asks it to provide tracing information, it'll honor that request. Versus, you know, it can also, you know, ask other agents to provide tracing on an exchange by exchange basis.
Right. But what I'm saying is I don't want a mechanism that supports both. I want a mechanism that supports one, and then I want a mechanism that supports the other, and I don't want to mix them.
Why not?
Because mixing them is not an interoperable protocol concern. Analyzing what a protocol is doing is a protocol level question. Analyzing what an agent does is not a protocol level question and is not an interoperability thing.
I would definitely disagree with that. It is very much interoperability, but
it's interoperability for another party to be able to tell your agent to write something to its logs. I don't think so.
Only if you want to, but remember, it doesn't only write to the logs. It allows you to pass it along as part of the messages. And 100%, the other agent doesn't have to agree to do it. However, to achieve interoperability, this is a pretty powerful tool that helps us get there.
Well, Evernym agents do logging a different way than this. I'm not interested in doing logging in an interoperable way. I see no benefit in interoperable logging. I'm interested in doing troubleshooting in an interoperable way because inherently troubleshooting in DIDCOM crosses vendor stack boundaries. I don't think logging crosses vendor stack boundaries.
Okay, I get that. The question of though, there's a couple of other points you made, like the intention you said was at a message level. It actually was at a protocol level, I believe. I think you probably...
Basically, the intention is at a message level, not a protocol level.
Really?
You can't say, I want this whole protocol to be traced in the original version of that RFC, I don't think.
There's the parameter.
The value in that, otherwise.
Well, the parameter that was specified in the RFC was the full thread parameter. And the parameter
full thread is not something that I put in the RFC. That's your change.
No, there's the comment here. Let me share my screen again.
Well, maybe I'm remembering that one wrong then. Maybe that was a subsequent evolution that we added. It wasn't in the original draft.
This is the comment around tracing entire threads. For entire multi-step interaction, the full thread attribute can be included. So based on this, I included the full thread attribute in the tracing decorator here.
Because it doesn't make sense, you know, you tracing a message does not actually get ever back, means it doesn't ever get, the information never gets back to the person who turned tracing on. It only goes to the person who receives the message.
No, the tracing information is emitted to whatever the sink is, and that's true no matter.
Oh, if it's an external sink, but
yes,
but right. But there can be a sink as a attachment to the message. I'm not sure attachment is the right word. As an addition to the message.
I don't know what you mean by that. Say more about that.
One of the things Ian did, I believe, was that at a thread level, correct me Ian on this, that you can say, attach the tracing information to the messages of the protocol so that as messages flow back and forth, they actually get added to the message.
Yeah, Stephen, that's something that we talked about but didn't implement yet.
So oh, okay.
Right now, the tracing can go either to standard out to the log file, or it can go to the HTTP endpoint.
Okay, so I get what you mean about other than protocol messaging, agent tracking, and I'm good with that as being a separate and not even part of the RFC. I am interested in the more capable protocol tracking that we're talking about here. And even saying, even at a connection level, being able to say, I think is a reasonable use case. And again, always with the idea that the other side need not ever agree to it and need not ever turn it on.
Okay. Well, I could feel like pretty good about that. As soon as the notion that the tracing goes to a log gets introduced, I feel like we're mixing concerns. I remember this is supposed to be something that's coming from the other side. So if Alice says to Bob, hey, Bob, please trace this to your local logs, I don't see how that's interoperable or helpful. It's helpful if you are controlling both sides of an interaction and you want to tell your own agent from the outside to please do something, but I don't think that's the subject of this RFC.
Okay.
Other part about making this more, so the notion of putting the tracing into the messages themselves, where you say, look, I'd like to just bundle this, that actually makes a lot of sense to me and is cool. But it's not adequately described. So okay, we would have to say something along the lines of, here is how tracing interacts with routing. It is now part of a mediator's job to repackage a message where you have the core message plus some tracing information associated with it, instead of just passing along an inner envelope. And we would have to tell people who are sending messages and want tracing to be enabled to make the request to trace visible in every envelope they prepare. Because it doesn't do any good to say just to the final recipient, I want tracing. By the time it got to the final recipient, your need for tracing is probably gone. It's all the intermediate points that make it interesting.
So on the topic of local logging versus transmitting to a sink, I think that the concern of whether it's logged locally or not is outside the scope of the RFC and interoperability. Yeah. But it certainly isn't harmful if it happens, right? If they decide that they're going to log stuff, that's fine. But from an interoperability, like in a sink management perspective, the important part is it gets sent to the sink. So if the whole point is, hey, please trace this, and then it only goes to local logs, that doesn't make sense. But if you say, please trace this, and the information ends up in the sink, then what else happens, I think, is the concern of the local software. And I don't know if that's entirely what you meant or not, Daniel.
That's saying it better than I did.
Well, that's a first.
No, it's not. That happens all the time.
Cool.
And to add one more thing to what Daniel said, the shift to bulk, I think, actually was quite intentional. And I think, again, it's super useful. If you are in a high volume use case that you're trying to understand, and where, you know, errors happen intermittently and so on, that's exactly where this becomes really valuable. So the high volume is, I think, a useful attribute that we're talking here, which is why it comes back to, you know, setting it for a connection or setting it for a protocol.
I think that from your local development perspective, Stephen, that's totally valid. But I think from a protocol perspective, the way to do this in bulk is to send all of your message with the please trace.
Yeah, that's true. That could be just a matter of, but then you, yeah. So whether you record that, I mean, how you implement that is a good question. You're probably going to put a flag on your connection and say, every time you send something to this guy, make sure you send the trace thing. But I agree that that's a local question.
So if you want to enable that from a local debugging perspective and have it end up in a log file using a similar mechanism because it's kind of tied together, game on, right?
Yeah.
But yep, I think exactly. Trying to put the bulk thing into the tracing thing at a protocol level is probably the mistake that I think Daniel is trying to avoid.
Well, it was always the case with the theory of decorators that you could attach a decorator at different scopes. And the decorator RFC says one of the scopes is a protocol and another is a connection. Yeah. And so if we're accomplishing our need to express intent by adding a decorator somewhere, and the place that we add it is a connection, then I don't have any heartburn over doing connection-wide requests for tracing. But if we said, oh, we want it at the level of an agent in all of its connections or something, then I feel like we've basically strayed beyond the bounds of DIDCOM, and it's no longer a protocol level construct at all.
It's certainly inappropriate to ask another agent to then trace all of its agent stuff, right? That's outside of your concern when you're a third party.
I agree. Yeah, I agree.
So I think part of the confusing thing here is that what they've done is they've intermingled, to great utility, they've intermingled their code that performs tracing with their code that performs bulk local logging. And that's okay so long as the tracing protocol operates as intended. I don't think it's a bad behavior necessarily. They're quite similar in function, meaning local bulk logging and tracing an individual message. So if you want to reuse a message within your code to do that, I don't see a problem with that so long as the protocol conversation with other agents asking to do tracing remains, true to that relationship.
Yeah, I think this conversation has made me happy because Ian had done a lot of important work on this topic and raised the PR. And what I said in the PR comment is, I feel like there's some subtleties here and it would be best to talk about them interactively instead of trying to pick them apart in the PR comment stream. And I've now explained why I felt there were some distinctions that are useful, but I'm cheerful however we decide this, as long as we have the conversation mostly. I hope that logging becomes a separate concern. It could be a derivative concern, meaning that we say in the RFC, if you want to log when this is going on, here's how it could work, but that's kind of outside the scope of the RFC's specific requirements. So that what Ian has done would fit naturally with the RFC. I just don't want to require everybody to react to logging the same way.
It is kind of interesting though. Well, you'd only ever use it on a dev scenario. Yeah, connection is the broadest one you would ever use it for. Never mind. I think your point about agent-wide was really accurate. So we have to look at the PR to make sure of that. The value of being able to have a single sync for this is pretty, I was just thinking of the value that it provided. It was a huge help when we started using it. So don't want to lose much of the value it provides, but I think you've got the right focus on protocols and at the protocol level, the RFC level, you've got it right, Daniel.
Okay, and then the other thing that we could do would be to maybe have a second PR, and if Ian wanted to volunteer for this would be great, or you, Stephen, or if nobody else will, I will, but it'd be great to have a second PR that says, here's how tracing works when routing is kind of complicated.
Yeah, because it does, you're right, that does put extra on the forward message and how each step has to deal with that.
Yeah. Okay.
Awesome. Well, that timeliness worked out because we're at about our self-imposed limit here. So next on the agenda is talking about the UX of accepting connections. And I should preface this by saying I don't mean to be mad at our former selves, because we've come a long way. In the beginning of connections, we were just trying to get anything to work at all. And now we have the benefit of being able to look around a little bit and think a little deeper about it without the same immediate concerns. And I think that that's what's helped me to sort of have some realizations that I would like to share and see if they're useful as we move forward. There is a thread in the Aries channel about this, and that might be entertaining. Hopefully this will summarize that if you don't want to go spend the time to read through that. Our current UX flow in agents is typically this. Bob sends an invitation to Alice, and then we're going to pretend Alice is on a mobile phone here and is a user, and Alice it gets presented a user experience to like accept or ignore the invitation. And so the moment of invitation is actually fairly important here. This is good. We want Alice to be in control of what actually happens. And so asking Alice with that information is a really good thing. And it's been a sort of an ongoing sort of subtle conversation that a good user experience here needs something like a name or an image, an avatar. If it's a company, the company logo would be really useful at that point, so that when Alice is actually accepting the message, she has some context and can feel comfortable about what's going on. Not just that the right thing is happening, but that Alice sort of understands at a basic level what's going on here. The problem with that is that if we don't do it well, then we end up with pretty bad phishing attacks. And we had a discussion about the label in an invitation a long time ago and about whether we should include that or not, because it wasn't really verifiable. It was a self-asserted thing. And by limiting it to label, we sort of mostly avoided the problem, or at least punted it down the road. The struggle here, and there's a current conversation about what we could actually add to this to like standardize the process of presenting an image as far as what's going on here. And I struggle with this because of the same thing, but there's another reason why I think this is problematic besides phishing. And that is, the more we try to standardize what produces a good user experience, the more we run into a problem in that this happens before the exchange of data is actually complete and we have a secure channel to actually communicate across. And so we as a community, and again, I've likely been a significant contributor to this, we think of the moment of accepting an invitation as the important moment for Alice to be in control of what's actually going on. And I believe that mental model that we've ended up with has led us into the problem. One of the issues is that an invitation often has information passed in the clear, so there's a little bit more information leakage going on there. There's some struggle there. We could, and it might, I'll get to this at the end, but it might be the right answer in the short term to actually do that, to actually enhance invitations with other types of information to be able to present a better user experience to Alice in a way that is secure and can't really be easily phished. But it occurred to me that the problem is that I don't want to keep modifying invitation as we come up with better and better ways to provide this information. I would like the exchange of DIDs to be a relatively simple thing, and then we can evolve with protocols after a connection is established to provide all sorts of rich information back and forth as we're trying to figure that out. And so here's a little bit of a solution, right? We move the accept UX for Alice to after the exchange of DIDs. And I've got a similar picture that shows what that means. And what that means is that the presentation of good information happens over the secure channel. If we establish the connection, we can engage in protocols and we consider the connection tentative or preliminary or pending or something like that. Then we can engage protocols, really rich ones like credential exchange, over that channel to be able to establish trust And that's what we really want, is we want Alice to trust the experience that's going on, or make a trust decision about the person she's connecting with. So that's likely to change over time. We don't really have an issue right now of like business credentials for business names, locations, and logos per se. I hope we do in the future. So if we're going to use something in the intermediate sense now, then we're going to have to evolve that later, and handling that after the experience or after the connection has been established gives us an opportunity to do that in normal protocol level with the abilities that we actually have. If we do that, then we move the UX to after the exchange of DIDs and trust information. Now the user has verifiable information that they can use, whether they want to air quote accept this connection. And then I believe we have the best of both worlds here. We have information passed in a secure manner. We can engage rich protocols to be able to establish trust that can iterate over time and have a little bit of flexibility in how that's done. And we still place the user in control of what's actually happening here. It's true that her agent will have already established a secure connection with the other side, but that doesn't mean that it's willing to engage willy-nilly in any sorts of interactions. Because of its preliminary state, and will still be very restrictive about how it interacts until Alice has approved that connection. So we don't lose any control of the user, and we gain the ability to have protocol enabled verifiable information that can be as rich as we desire. So here's what that picture looks like. The invitation happens. Alice's agent just engages with it. Request, response, complete. And then I have two very vaguely named arrows here. And the idea here is that the protocols or interactions that Alice is going to use to trust or to decide what to present to Alice on whether she should accept and trust this connection appropriately. And so this could be verifiable credential exchange, but there's some other things we've been talking about, like the potential of using the well-known DID configuration described at the diff, which is a way for a domain owner, like bankco.com, to be able to place a well-known file that associates them strongly with a public DID, and that is information that could be exchanged over here. It's not precisely a verifiable credential, but it's information that can be verified that could provide a foundation of trust, and we can do that before we have a great, well-known issuer for business names, et cetera. After these exchanges happen between Alice and Bob, I show two arrows here, but this could be more of a negotiation as it happens, likely guided by a governance framework that Alice has engaged in. And then we present the UX to Alice to accept or to ignore that connection. If she ignores it, we're going to delete the work that we've done up to that point. And a good analogy here might be TLS. When you go to example.com, some website in a browser, it's going to do some stuff in the background to establish a secure connection and then transfer initial information. After seeing what comes up in my browser, I might go away because there's something that concerns me. I don't see the Better Business Bureau logo on the site is a little bit of a trivial example of what might make me do that. But after I see that initial information, I can decide to go away, and my browser will discard that information for me, because it's something that I've decided to not further engage in. And that's a shift of mental model. We've started out with the fact that making a connection at all we've said repeatedly that connections aren't about trust. Trust comes later, but then we've engaged in a user experience that kind of implies that it is about trust. That in order for Alice to accept a connection, she has to have enough information to make a good decision at that point. So I think working to shift our mental model so that the cryptographic piece of this is something that is pre-work that we're willing to do, then we can present the user. Alice gets a really great user experience because not only can it be very rich with all sorts of information, but that information can actually be verified in ways that help Alice make a good decision about what's happening. And that's a really powerful aspect of this. So I want your opinions, and I'll take questions here in a minute, but I've just got a little bit more of this concept that I wanted to share. These two arrows are a little vague on purpose, and that's because there's lots of possible reasons as a foundation for trust. A super obvious one is verifiable credentials, right? Hey, there's a known issue that I trust. Maybe it's my country government that's going to issue these things, and I'm going to believe the name of the company. So that if I'm walking into a burger joint and I receive a credential because of an invitation that's there. And it matches the name of the burger joint that I'm walking into, I have some, reasonable amount of trust there. This is ideal to have things involving VCs, but we don't really have good foundations for this yet. One that is doable now, I already mentioned, is the well-known DID configuration, and that will verify domain. And so Alice, in addition to being presented with the image, like the logo, can also be presented, a valid domain. This is bankco.com that's actually trying to make a connection with you. And we can do enough of a validation of that, that it's reasonably secure and becomes not trivially phishable, which is really valuable if someone's trying to interact this way. Other things that might be useful in a more social way, if I'm not an established company that you're trying to make a connection with, is something like a proof of email or phone number or maybe proof of social media channel control. If you've met me at IAW and you know that I'm Telegram Sam on Twitter, I might be able to present you a credential that proves ownership of that social media channel. And that might be a useful thing as a foundation of trust for you. One of the nice parts about having these be a variety of other protocols, not only can they improve, but we can have a variety of ones. When Alice says, please give me a basis for trust, she might accept a variety of things. She might accept proof of a social media channel or a well-known DID configuration or a VC. And whatever you're able to provide, Alice can then use to present to the user. She can verify that and then use it to present to the user. Alice's agent can present to Alice about how to make that decision. So there's work required here. The way that we've written our agents would need to be adjusted so that we're capable of having a not yet accepted connection and an accepted connection, and do some interactions there prior to that actually happening. And we also don't really have at this point these trust basis protocols. We have VC stuff, but we don't really have a good way to say, hey, I need a basis of trust from you. And so we're probably going to need some level of protocol there that helps facilitate those interactions. It's worth noting that these are new protocols because we don't have them yet, but it's not the connection or the DID exchange protocol itself that actually imposes this UX. It's a mental model about how the protocol actually applies. So those protocols don't actually need adjustment here. It's the mental model of how we're going to apply those protocols into the software that we do. Okay, and here's the questions that I have at the end. Is this worth fixing? Should we do this? What are the benefits? Is the work so much that we should just wait for something like DIDCOM V2 to come around and solve it then? Are there ways that we could move there gradually, either individually or as a community? And finally, do agent UXs actually need to align? If mobile agent A and mobile agent B both exist and mobile agent B updates to this new mental model, obviously there's some support for whatever the trust basis protocols are, but it would actually be possible, I believe, for agent B to change when they ask Alice the question without mobile agent A necessarily doing so. I may be wrong about that. It depends a little bit on protocol support and some other deeper questions, but this is the concept that I hope to present, is that moving from the UX from an early concept to a later concept, I believe, solves a variety of problems. One is that DID exchange can remain simple. And two is that by the time we actually ask the user to make a decision, we have good verifiable information to present to them instead of stuff that can be easily phished. Okay, I've talked a lot of words. Thoughts, comments, rebuttals, corrections?
Love it. My two cents on your questions is, I don't think the UX necessarily has to be in sync, although my guess is exactly what you said, which is the UXs would follow along and do what the user base wants to see. But I think working on protocols to enable that basis of trust, I think your ideas there are pretty solid of what can be done. I think it'd be great to it sounds like we're going to, you know, build out a set of, these are the possible bases of trust to which you can reply with. So this has to be a sort of a higher level protocol than a verifiable credential. You may respond with a proof request of this type or this type or this type. And so what we've got to do is sort of figure out how to make that flexible. But I think it sounds like just some sort of protocol.
Yes, I think so. And I also want to point out that that's not a done thing. We're not going to like do that once and be like, well, we're done. We're going to realize.
What I mean is I think it'll be like a configuration which said, oh, here's a set of things you can prove with. Oh, and here's, we just added three more to this list.
Right. And these could be rich interactions. And it might be that the other person just never responds. Like, let's say some timeout, the agent could decide to still prompt Alice and say they provided no useful information or no verifiable information you still want to accept. That might be useful from a developer perspective, or they might just decide to completely hide that until Alice goes looking. So there's a variety of things here, and we're going to keep inventing new ways to have good bases of trust here. And so the goal is initially not to solve them all, but to get one that we can make happen. And I know that a huge driving force is to make the connect to a business case as solid as possible. That's a really high need in the community right now.
Whoever just talked with me, go ahead and I'll be quiet.
This is Keith. So as you were speaking, I wasn't seeing any need to change existing protocols in order to support this. But then I was thinking, would it be useful for the invitation to have some metadata that would allow the, in this case, Alice to know what type of, let's say, if it is going to be a proof request that is the basis for trust, you know, what type of thing might we be asking for? So for example, if I get an invitation from a corporation that I know I would want to, in that case, maybe I would want to do a proof of domain name. Whereas if it's an individual, you know, I may want to use, some social media thing in your examples.
So correct that the protocols themselves don't necessarily need updating to make this happen, with the exception of adding a new one to handle this sort of a thing. I'm inclined to be cautious about adding that sort of information into invitation, because that's, I think, precisely the thing that we're trying to avoid. And I think this is hypothetical until we've got a PR at least in front of us. I think we can come up with a way of doing a message like this that actually makes that work. Further, if this is an out-of-band invitation, the message that's actually passed along inside of it could actually be, a beginning message of whatever protocol that ends up with. So in that case, I don't actually think we need to update it. We can use the existing mechanism we've already designed into out-of-band invitations to probably accomplish that same goal.
Yeah, okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does, yeah. I was thinking of how Let's Encrypt uses, there are lots of other, like Let's Encrypt has multiple challenge mechanisms. And I think it seems to me in order to bootstrap this, that like in order to bootstrap the email, we need at least one or reputable issuer out there and that can verify an email and issue a credential. And that seems like a pretty easy app to write. Same for, you know, for phone numbers.
We got an app for that.
The BCGov actually has one.
It's an easy. Okay. Well.
Well, and there's a bigger picture here. Go ahead, Stephen.
The idea came up today, and we're going to start using it to do Rocket Chat authentication. So there you go.
Well, I want to get in the queue somewhere. Stick me in the queue, Sam.
Okay, I'll stick you right after my short comment. But keep going, Keith. Did you have other things to say?
No, I'm done.
Thank you for your comments. There's some work here that I think could be done by the Trust Over IP Foundation in designing governance or helping others to design governance frameworks around a simple basis of trust, both for businesses and for individuals. I can imagine that part of the what Alice will accept as a basis of trust will line up somewhat with the governance framework that she's decided to include. And it might be, for example, like proof of social media account. And that way she can, for an individual or something, you know, like a domain name for a business or, you know, VCs when we get there. We can be a little messy with this as we get going, but ultimately I think that's probably how it's going to line up is that there'll be some governance frameworks around, basis for initial trust, and the Trust Over IP Foundation can have a role there, was one of the thoughts that I had. Okay, Daniel, you're in the queue. The queue.
I have a bunch of things, same kind of a reaction as the other one, where I'm just going to dump out a bunch of things hodgepodge. First of all, I believe in this vision. I believe that we need to free ourselves from the limiting mental model that we've had, which I think is flawed. I think it would help us if we dropped the term connection entirely and used the term channel, because if you use the term channel, then all of our assumptions about trust go away and the TLS metaphor then becomes very clear. Nobody has problems with us establishing a secure TLS-based channel with some remote party before we decide whether we're going to log into the website. And by calling this a channel instead of a connection, it makes it less about people and more about the underlying tech encryption stuff. So that's just a suggestion. I feel like it's super, super important that we not defer some solution. That is, we can't keep going down a road where we tell people to put systems in production that allow a party to conduct a phishing attack over DIDCOM. Right now, DIDCOM has a reputation for being secure. And if we want to throw that reputation away, there's no better way to do it than to enable phishing attacks, because this is the number one cybersecurity risk in the world right now. For email, there were 76% of all businesses experienced a phishing attack last year. 95% of all attacks done on corporate networks right now happen after a phishing attack that enabled them. And Kaspersky is just one vendor. They had 246 million alerts on phishing attacks in email in, I don't know if it was 2019 or 2018. So this is a very big deal. We need to get it right. Even right now, we need to do something to improve the to improve our security posture. I'm concerned about the diagram that Sam's showing on the screen because it's purely sequential. And there are a couple of subtleties that make that feel problematic to me. The first one is that the out-of-band protocol, as Stephen Curran has described it to us and advocated very adroitly, and which I love, the out-of-band protocol lets you connect an invitation with some business process like, hey, I'd like to issue you a credential, or I'd like to sell you something or whatever. but it doesn't let you say, in between the invitation and issuing you the credential, I want to engage in a trust building exercise. So we've broken the diagram as currently shown on the screen actually breaks the out of band protocol. Unless the only thing you're inviting somebody to do is engage in trust building. Which brings me to another concern I have, which is that trust is not binary and it's not one time. You might ratchet up your trust 37 times over the length of a relationship. And I don't know how many of those would be associated with invitations of one kind or another and how many of them would just use an existing channel. But there's what I'm saying here reinforces Sam's point that trust building needs to be a separable concern, but it also causes me heartburn because we have built the out-of-band protocol to be go from nothing to a business process without accounting for the trust building in between. Last thing is, I think we need to think about how this relates to co-protocols. I could imagine something where you invite somebody to establish a channel, and then you engage in multiple conversations that run in parallel. One could be, let's build some trust. Another could be, let's start negotiating the price on something that we said we wanted to sell. And maybe there could be a third one even happening, like what kind of payments do you accept? So making it purely sequential, I think is a little bit, it's not a wrong simplification, but it's too much of a simplification. If we can't explain how it works in parallel, we're not there yet. Oh, one other thing to add. The notion of solving this problem by engaging in trust-based stuff or trust-building stuff is great, and VCs are great too, but today we don't have any issuers. So, like, especially issuers for credentials of an organization or institution. Because of that, it's not an option today to build trust about the identity of an institution using verifiable credentials. In 6 months, maybe we'll be past that bootstrap problem, but I just want to make sure people understand that we can't apply this whole solution today and have a satisfactory outcome unless we do something in addition to verifiable credentials. Okay, thanks for letting me do a brain dump.
That was good, Daniel. Stephen, you're on the queue, but I want to add a couple of comments. One is that I didn't intend my diagram to be sequential. The little flow diagram tool that I'm using right here doesn't let me put an arrow on both ends of the line. That was what I tried to do initially. And I think that that probably would have helped avoid that that misconception of what I intended. But I do, one of the things that can happen here is I'm looking at this from Alice's perspective, but it's entirely possible that Bob, on the completion of a connection, also treats Alice as a pending connection. And the same arrows are in reverse. So while Alice is talking about how Bob can provide a basis for initial trust, the same thing can be happening the other direction, which I think is also really useful. As far as initial trust, I probably should have put initial in the diagram right here. I never intended this to be all of the foundation of trust, just some trust, or at least enough trust for Alice to make a decision about whether to accept or ignore that channel. Also love the suggestion of channel. Works better than session, which is the other one that I'd been thinking of. And then I think that's probably my own comments. I do have thoughts about out of band, but I think that's why Stephen has his hand up. So I'm going to be quiet and let Stephen talk.
Could well be. So a couple of thoughts. One is I agree completely with what Daniel said, which is the out of band request attachments would follow the basis of trust discussion that would go on between the two parties. And agree that it's a back and forth, like Sam said. So we don't want to lose that registering that. One of the other things about out of band that we also want to make sure we figure out, and we're actually having a discussion on this, even with what we have for out of band, which is when you reuse, How do you say you're reusing it? So for example, is it sufficient to say you get an invitation and you look at it and realize it's someone you already have a connection with, therefore you bypass all of these things and jump right back to the, right down to the action that's being asked for. And you bypass even confirming the connection. So something to think about there. And we're already thinking about that on out of band without even the basis of trust. I did want to underline, Daniel, you said that there was no organizational trust, but I think that's what Sam was talking about with the well-known DID associated with the DNS entry that DIF is working on. And I think that has some merit as a possibility of one for organizations, because it's something that they can do with relative little friction. So that is one. And certainly the examples for human trust, we can look at what Keybase does for its various ways. I'm not sure if those can be reapplied generally, but that's an interesting question of whether the techniques that Keybase uses can be used in this, in this circumstance.
Yeah, plus one to the well-known DID idea. I like that. And I actually think that's the first thing I would try to go implement, because I think most of the time when we're trying to send something to build trust, it's about the institution proving its bona fides, because they're the one that's likely to be inviting, and the other party's trying to evaluate whether or not it's really the bank they're talking to, that kind of a thing. So well-known DID feels like a good low-hanging fruit here.
One of the interesting things, I agree. One of the interesting things is that placing the trust conversation right there actually goes a long way to automatically solving the man in the middle problem. That you have with this. If someone intercepts they intercept the invitation and present you their own, you know, they could stand in the middle there. But the basis of trust, particularly as we're promoting this concept that it's engaged in automatically and immediately, can automatically eliminate anyone who can't actually do something like prove ownership of a DID like that. And so it not just phishing, but man in the middle attack surfaces decrease substantially in that process, which I hadn't thought about till just right now, but that's really exciting to me. Because that's kind of been a lurking issue that we know exists. And we knew that the solution was something like VCs, but we didn't have a good mechanism to get there. Something that I think we should do immediately is begin at least a rough proposal for what this conversation might be like. And with the goal of kind of producing something not maybe perfect, but good enough to start with, and then we can discuss how it might be augmented or improved as things continue. And then the other one, which is related to that, is, hey, let's actually engage on this proof of DID domain linkage, because that's something that is something that we can do now, right? That's an existing spec that works, and we don't have to like wait for anyone as an organization to show up and start issuing things. We can just do that. The other thing is that we still need a way in the basis of trust to provide maybe self-asserted information. And that's what we can do from an initial perspective on a personal level until we get something like proof of social media channels or proof of email address or other types of information up off the ground. I'm thinking of not just how we deploy this before those institutions are ready to go, but also how a developer that's doing things on their desktop can make this work as well. Steven.
I would slightly vary what you just said, which is let's get working on this. Let's figure out how to request a basis of trust at a high level. I would say work on the send me proof of your email address and send me proof of, you know, DIF DNS as two sort of examples we could start with, one for a person, one for a organization. They may not last. They may get eliminated as we go. We do things like pass a nonce and figure out things like that. So we prevent replay attacks and stuff like that. And we figure it out using those two and then make that a template that others can add more to it. But you know, just what you said about, oh yeah, what could come back included with the basis of trust, like a logo or something like that. That's super interesting as well. So we could start to tease out those ideas while we just use those two simple basis as the start.
So, Daniel? I want to find out from somebody, do we have anybody who's making a mobile agent besides Evernym on this call? Do we have like Ozma people or Trinzic people? Because I essentially pitched this idea to Evernym's product management. And what they said is, we get the theory, but we're unwilling to give up the logo and the name of the other party in our user experience while we go fiddle with this. And that's primarily the viewpoint informed by a consumer app. It, in the case of, you know, me as a theory guy and Stephen, whose head is completely wrapped around the enterprise side and an expert there, I think it's easier for us to agree to it. But I think these product people that are looking at the user experience of an ordinary human in a mobile app are kind of resistant to being theoretical. So I got pushback.
So super interesting to know how long these interactions would take, because I wonder how long they're really going to take. If you don't have a pop-up that comes up until after, how long from a scanning a QR code till you actually get the pop-up at the bottom there? I don't think it'll be long.
Well, we could also, if Alice is already involved in the invitation because she like scanned a QR code, we can also, you know, I think of the reticulating splines thing, right? You give them, you can give them a little bit of a status indicating like, hey, this is going. And I don't also think it will take that long in the normal case. In the case of a bad network connection because you happen to be at a convention with 50 million other people, maybe that'll happen sometime in the future. Then we might, the user experience might be a little less.
So the pushback wasn't about timing. That wasn't why they were concerned. They were concerned that there's no useful mechanism that could accomplish the same thing. So basically, we'd have to live without a feature for X number of months while we go build something to replace the insecure version that we have today.
Well, what I'm thinking would help this conversation from product development perspective is to actually try and narrow down as efficiently as possible what we propose the replacement to be. And I think that the domain name based did one is the right one. Is the right one to pursue from a business perspective because of how urgent that is in the community. Nearly every use case I know of a company that's trying to make money with this involves a user connecting to a business. And so that would be really valuable. To your point, Daniel, it's incredibly important that at least Trinzic has an opportunity to weigh in on this concept. I was hoping they'd be here today, and possibly Ozma folks as well, and
eSatis folks.
eSatis as well.
Yeah.
And so one of the things we need to do is sort of float this past them, and perhaps we can send the recording of this and ask them to review and send feedback, and that would be a useful way of engaging. Does anyone want to take a stab? Is anyone willing to volunteer to take a stab at what a protocol to engage the well-known DID configuration, what that might look like?
I can do it if nobody else volunteers. I wrote up a document that actually would have engaged it a different way, so I could go modify that. It wouldn't be that hard, I guess.
Is your other document more worthwhile, or?
Well, I'm not very enthused about well-known DID if we frame it as a protocol. I was more enthused about it when it was invoked as a, you know, a decorator or a field in an invitation. If we're doing it as a protocol, then I think Well-Known did, Well-Known did requires a verifiable credential, so we might as well just say, give us the verifiable credential, in which case we already have a protocol for it.
No, I don't think so. Well-Known did doesn't require, I don't think. It just
it requires does require that you publish. It does require that you publish a verifiable credential that is,
You
create a JSON file in the .wellknown folder on your website, and the JSON file has to reference a self-issued verifiable credential. There has to be a digital signature from the DID that you're going to end up using.
But the protocol might be really simple. It might be just, I am this domain. Right. And then you go get the Well-Known file and actually run the verification process. But there needs to be a little bit of something for Bob to tell Alice so that Alice knows that, number one, it has a domain, right, that's capable of doing that and which one to go check on.
But I think the basis of trust protocol needs to be at a much higher level where that's just one of the options. So the basis of trust protocol request and response should be even, you know, should allow for the range of options where one of the responses is a Well-Known DID.
It's almost a list of protocols saying, these are the protocols I'd like to use to establish a basis of trust. And it's not all protocols because not all protocols help with trust. That would be something like that. I will try and take a stab at the high level one. I'm going to do it in a markdown file, probably on HackMD, just because I want to be able to move fast on this and everything else and float these. So I'll try to do that, Daniel. And if you have a chance to do the same, then we can try to move forward from there and see if we can come up with what we think the right answer is, sooner rather than later. That will also help the discussions with Trinzic and ESADIS, et cetera, to get some feedback from them on how much they like this answer and or are willing to put in development time in the not long term to make it happen.
Awesome. I'll try to help. I just can't. It would be useless for me to volunteer to drive it. So, Sam, I'd really appreciate it, but I'd love to help. I'm cool. Really intrigued with this. This is a great idea.
Okay, we are over time. I'm grateful for everyone that survived this long. And if you know of someone that is making an agent, please, I'll try to get this recording posted sooner rather than later. And if you could circulate this around and we can get some feedback from these other groups, this would be really useful to hear feedback about it generally and about what we're proposing. Thanks, everyone, for coming. I hope you have a fantastic week. Remember, if you haven't signed the card for John and you would like to do that soon so that can be sent up to him and other communications, we can send it through Stephen Curran and he can filter out all of the Stephen Curran criticism. Awesome. thanks, everybody. And I hope your week is a good one.